Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us if you're watching the program, and good evening to this wonderful full house here at the Poison Tent. This is Riley's first appearance here, so we're all terribly excited about that. Yay!
Thank you for coming.
But during COVID, he has been wonderful about Zooming with us. We've done, what, two or three?
Two, yeah.
Yep, and he's signed loads of books for us remotely, so it's nice that he was able to come here. For those of you new to the store, this is actually the small part, is the rest of the building is the bookstore. So Riley was in the back room dealing with bags of books, right?
Signing lots of copies.
Lots of copies, right. So Riley has a sort of interesting story, and since he's new to us, you might want to hear it, because he started out not as a bestseller, but rather,
no.
Well, tell him your story. It's your story, not mine.
Well, yeah, so I think, show of hands, like, how many of you know that, like, Riley is not my real name? Like,
hi.
Hi. That's a secret. Right. Yeah, so I wrote books under my real name, and they didn't do that well at all. And so I wrote a book that some of you might have heard of called Final Girls. And I sent it to my agent, and my agent said, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This could be a big breakout book for you. It's the best thing you've ever done. You're going to have to use a pen name. And I said, no. And she said, well, that's kind of not how publishing works. She's like, you could put your name on it, and it will sell probably less than your previous books, because all the editors I sent it to will look at the sales of your previous books, and it will just tank, and you don't want that because this book is too good for that.
And so, sadly, lesser bookstores than ours will do the same thing. They will look at Barnes & Noble and see, oh, he sold 19 copies of his Todd Ritter book, and so they won't even bother to buy the new book. And that really is part of the reason editors are not interested.
Yeah, it's cutthroat. It's really a brutal business. And so I did, came up with Riley Sager, which Sager is my grandmother's maiden name. And Riley is, my parents are named Ray and Linda, and so I was going to use initials, and I'm like, R.L. Sager, that's brilliant. And then it took me literally like 2 seconds where I'm like, oh, R.L. Stein kind of has that market cornered, so, and I'm like, Riley's close enough, and so that's how Riley Sager was born.
And the other good thing is that by changing his name, Riley has been able to write different books every time, right? He's not writing a series with one lead character. And that's not that easy to do, because publishers like to brand people, and they like you to expect, oh, look, it's another Janet Ivanovich, so you already know, it's going to be Stephanie Plum and the whole bit. It's hard to build a career on basically what we call standalone books. In other words, books that don't have any connection to any other book you've written, but you've been able to do that, right?
Yeah, and I, because the books under my Todd name were, it was a series, and it kind of sucked to have like a whole like 6-book arc in mind, and then you had to like finish it up in 3, where I'm like, okay, all these things that were going to happen over a couple years, it's done in a week, and then you just wrapped it all up, and then, yeah, so I will never do like a series or a sequel. So like people ask me like, oh, would you ever like revisit like The Last Time I Lied? And I'm like, no. So like it'll all be standalones, because I like creating like the new worlds and the new characters and the crazy situations. Like series are great to read, but I just don't want to.
But not write every author wants to do world building. How many of you read science fiction? A lot of you? All right, so the world building is a really critical part of science fiction, right? You have to make it all up. And basically, that's what Riley is doing with each one of his books. It's not like, in the future or, on another planet or anything, but he has to come up with an entire new world. Not everybody wants to do that.
Yeah, for me, it's part of the fun challenge of tackling a new book, is just coming up with this new, whether it's a creepy apartment building in Manhattan or, a secluded lake and the lake houses on it. Like, there's just something fun for me about just coming up with a new setting.
You bet. And a new story structure, too.
Yes.
So the house across the lake is what I would call a new Gothic. And you're probably going to ask, what is a new Gothic? Does anybody know what an old Gothic is? A traditional Gothic? How many of you have read Rebecca? Some of you have read Rebecca. So So let's talk about what a Gothic is, because it's a good way to sort of describe this book.
Yeah, and Gothics, new Gothics are very, very popular right now.
They are.
And it's basically, it involves a woman in peril. It involves, like, there's a lot of atmosphere, and like in this case, there's a storm coming in on the lake, and so like it's a dark and stormy night. That's a very, very Gothic thing. There's just like, there's peril and like a very closed off atmosphere. Like in the house across the lake is fairly small, and there are, gosh, I forget. I have to count the number of houses on it. One, two. There are 5 houses on the lake. And so it is this very closed off atmosphere. And so like the number of suspects and people who populate it are few, but they have lots and lots of secrets.
Right, you have to have sinister backstories for everybody. Actually, to make a real Gothic, you need a creepy house or a castle or, no, seriously, because the thing is that you don't want people just trickling in from all over involved in it. You have to have a closed environment. If you're an Agatha Christie reader, then you will know about the country house murder, which could be a boat on the ocean, or it could be a theater, or it could be, you know, an English manor house or whatever it all is. But it limits the number of people who are in the story and can be suspects if there's anything bad going on. So any of you read Edgar Allan Poe, The Fall of the House of Usher, for example? Notice the title, The Fall of the House of Usher. If you read Rebecca, it's really about the house to a great degree, and it's all over when the house burns down. You know, Mrs. De Winter never actually gets a name in Rebecca. She is so incidental to the house and all that they never give her a name other than Mrs. De Winter. So
right, and that's so wild that the narrator of the book is never named, but the book is called Rebecca.
Right.
Because it's the first Mrs. De Winter. Yeah, love that.
And if you read Ruth Ware, for example, she's written a couple of books that are basically the same structure, the new Gothic thing. So in order to do this, then, you had to create this terrific house. So tell us about the house.
Well, there are 2 houses, and there's the house that Casey, the main character, is in. And that is pretty much a house that I stayed at in Vermont. It was during the pandemic, like, shot all my vacation plans to heck. And so I just needed to get out of the house. You know, you got that, I think you all can relate. We're just like, okay, I need to get out of here. And so we rented a lake house in Vermont for a week, and it was just this big cottage right on the water that was like really old, but they fixed it up over the years. And the very first night, I poured myself a bourbon, went to the back porch that overlooked the water, sat down in a rocking chair, and looked at the houses on the other side of the lake. And they were all lit up and pretty, and I'm not a voyeur. Let me just like make that clear.
No, but you really are. Come on, Riley. You really are in this book. You are definitely a voyeur.
But in that moment, I just did this. I was like, oh, who lives there? What is their life like? Have they ever murdered someone? And it's just like little questions about like the lives of the people in that house. And I was really just curious, like, who does live there and what is their life like? And I may or may not have searched the rental lake house for binoculars, and there weren't any. But so that got me thinking about like Rear Window on a Lake was like the first thing that popped into my head. And so, but in order to do that, you need another house. And so Casey's house is a nice cottage. The house across the lake is this big modern stone and steel and glass thing with like these massive glass walls, because all the better to look into. And so like that is the house across the lake. And it is like a very Gothic setting, but it's like a very unexpected modern. It's not like this old haunted moldering castle or manor. It's like this big modernist structure.
Hence the new Gothic.
Hence the new Gothic.
Right. So have you all seen Rear Window? Jimmy Stewart, Grace Kelly, and do you know who the guy was that they were staring across? It was Raymond Burr before he became, who did he become? Perry Mason?
Perry Mason,
wasn't?
Yeah.
So it was Raymond Burr, who was a big, you know, burly guy and so easy to watch. And then I'm trying to think, something. Oh, the Woman in the Window, the A.J. Finn book, is a little bit like that, too.
Yeah, but and Girl on the Train was also a variation on that. There have been...
Right.
Yeah, and it's a really... It's not a new kind of plot, but it's an evergreen kind of plot. And yeah. I think the reason it's been done so often and so well is because it's really, really flexible. You can mm-hmm. set it lots of places and do lots of different things with it, and it just always, always works.
You bet. In fact, in publisher or editor speak, excuse me, it becomes what's called the instigating incident. In other words, something has to kick off the story, right? I mean, at some point, there has to be some place for a story to begin. There has to be some traction. And so looking into somebody else's life through a window or a train window, I think Patricia Highsmith did something similar, too, where, you know, you're watching, looking into a window into somebody's life.
Didn't even Agatha Christie do it?
Yeah, probably. And if you think about it, Instagram is actually
yeah,
perfect.
Instagram is. Yeah.
Except now we're all inviting everybody to look into
no, and that's something that, like, I do address a little bit in The House Across the Lake, because the couple on the other side of the lake is Tom and Catherine Royce, and Catherine is a former supermodel, and her husband Tom is a tech guru who created this app called Mixer, where, like, you know, like work and play mix. And so it's kind of like LinkedIn, but with like alcohol. And but yes, but like there's, you can locate people. And so like he created this thing where you can track people's location, and people willingly sign up for this. And right. That was this idea of like, is it okay to be looking in people's houses when they are showing you their lives on Instagram and like signing up for apps where you can track people? Yeah. And what's the moral cutoff point? Like, it's okay to look at them on Instagram, but not through binoculars.
Well, you know,
which I mean, that's true. It's very true to not do that. Like, that is a given, right?
Splitting hairs here. I mean, I think about children. Any of you see the Instagram stream? I don't even know why I get it, from John Legend and Chrissy Teigen. Is her name Chrissy?
Chrissy Teigen.
Their kids are the subject of that. I mean, those kids can't make a move without her putting them on Instagram. And I think there's some really interesting questions involved. We're digressing, but we always do in our events, so hang on. But yeah. I think it's a really interesting question, whether, because there is some kid that was a diaper baby or some. Do you remember, Patrick, who it is? He sued his parents. And
the Nirvana baby.
Yeah,
right, exactly. So I asked myself, you know, whether one of these Teigen kids is going to grow up and say, wait, you know, you put my whole childhood out there for people to look at without my consent. It really is, in a way, violating their privacy. This is a different thing for adults, but I'm talking about adults.
Right, and some, like Kristen Bell, if you follow her on Instagram, like she will put like smiley face emojis over a kid's face. And I think that's like the proper way to do it. Like to just like, here's your kid, but you can't really see who the child is. Yeah. So like it's giving them some amount of privacy.
There have been some great crime novels about people, you know, who are posting their vacation pictures all over Instagram, and all it's an invitation, you know, for robbers to come and take away everything. So, you know, it's a really tough modern question. What is privacy, you know, and how much do you want to give up in order for some sort of connection or celebrity, and how much not? And you've got a supermodel. So
yes.
She's a person in the book. She's a person who is already accustomed to that because she's a supermodel.
Yeah, and that was, I understand like the improbability that, like, because Casey is a fairly well-known actress and Catherine is a supermodel, and I don't know what lakes anyone else goes to, but the lakes I go to, there are not actresses and supermodels there. But and so I knew that was kind of a stretch, but I wanted them to have careers in which they were looked at. Like, I wanted where being watched was part of their job.
Right.
And then I wanted to turn the tables. So, like, Casey, who was used to being watched on the stage, is now doing the watching in a house, like, at a house where she describes as lit up like a stage set. And Catherine, who is on billboards and magazine spreads, this is not a spoiler because it's in the jacket copy, she vanishes. So I liked that idea of playing around with like people who are used to being watched are now either doing the watching or are gone.
Are gone.
Yes.
Gone with the wind, right. So what is the marital situation of these two women? Because they're the main characters, but it's important to know what their family stuff is like.
Yes. Casey was happily married to a screenwriter named Len until he drowned at that lake. And Catherine is married to Tom, and their marriage is just picture perfect. But yeah, I saw your videos, and it's not. So, and Casey is, the reason she's at the lake house is because she's gotten into a bit of bad publicity, and her mother is like, okay, you're either going to rehab or you're going to the lake house to dry out and get your stuff in order. And so Casey chooses the lake house, even though, I mean, her husband drowned there. So that's seriously going to mess someone up. And so she befriends Catherine and becomes a little bit obsessed with Catherine, but it's also understandable because, you know, Casey's husband died and the people across the lake had this wonderful picture-perfect marriage. And so right there, Casey's probably not in the best headspace. And so when she starts to see hints that maybe the Royce marriage isn't as wonderful as it seems, she starts watching more. And then when Catherine suddenly is gone, then she decides to take action.
Isn't it true that every time somebody says their marriage is picture perfect,
it's
absolutely
not.
No, that's a lie. I mean, you know, it's like code for there's really bad stuff happening in this marriage behind the door.
Yes.
Right. So you actually have Casey dealing with addiction, right? She
yes.
is, she's a drunk.
Yep.
And so she's up there by the water to dry out. I love that. you know, that's part of her journey in this book, right?
Yeah. I mean, Casey is like the quintessential alcoholic woman looking out a window at her neighbors. And the reason I did that is because kind of the trope called for it. Like, I love these kinds of books where, like, this kind of stuff happens. And I wanted to lean in as much as possible to the tropes because I think it's more interesting when things veer off course from the tropes. And this is where, like, you know, there could be spoilers abound in this book. And, like, it's so hard to be, like, talking about it. But, like, things are definitely not what they seem at that lake and in those houses. And so I really liked the idea of toying with the tropes, sort of like y'all saw the Kristen Bell show on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah, not as extreme as that, not as like humorous as that, but just to really throw in like some good old fashioned, like, okay, yes, she's drinking bourbon and pulls out the binoculars and spies on the neighbors. And you know, the guy who lives next door is not only hot, but he's like super hot and a former cop. And that kind of stuff. We're just playing with like the tropes and having fun with it. And so that was part of my goal, was like just to have fun.
Sure. Or he has to know what the tropes are in order to make fun of them. But even more important, you need to know what they are in order for you to recognize what he's doing. So, you know, it's good. Do most of you read a number of books in this genre? I mean, you know, you just don't read Riley and nothing else? I mean, he'd like that, but... Right.
No, read other people, too, because
right,
they're awesome people out there.
You know, and they're foundational books, like the Agatha Christie books and so forth, you know, that will help you recognize when an author is playing with them and updating them. I mean, the crime genre is relatively new. Probably earliest was around 1850 or something, so it's not a super old. It's not Jane Austen.
You know? Right.
And there are patterns. So it's fun if you know what the patterns are, and then you can break them.
And it was really fun to recognize the breakage, right? Yes. And I think, like, you all, my readers are really savvy. So, like, I think they know, like, because you guys knew what a final girl was. Like, and you guys knew, like, you know, with Lock Every Door, like, okay, it's kind of Rosemary's Baby-ish. And so, like, it's like, I like playing with like an audience like this, where like you know what to expect, and you know that there's gonna be something different about it. And that,
and
to me, is really fun.
There's something really different about it, but you're going to have to read it to find out. We're not going any farther.
So, I've heard it described as banana pants, and that's fairly accurate. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, right. Recognize that Riley was having fun writing the book, and so you should have fun coming to the end of it. So, since we haven't ever had a chance to talk to you about your earlier books, maybe you could either take questions or you could talk about the other books. Walk us through the books that you wrote leading up to this.
As Riley books?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because my other...
No, we're going to leave Todd buried somewhere.
Because Todd's out of print. Like, yeah. You can't even get him on Kindle. Yeah, yeah, he's just gone. Yeah. So, yeah, there was Final Girls. Well, let's do hands if you've read Final Girls. Nice. Okay, and then there was Last Time I Lied, which was like summer camp fun. Oh, I see a Final Girl. Yeah. Nice. And then there was Lock Every Door. Cool. Home Before Dark got a lot of yes. And then last summer was Survive the Night.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah, and they're all like, I'm inspired very much by movies. Like, if anyone who's read Survive the Night knows, like, I'm a big movie fan, and movies I see as like a really great shorthand. Like, you don't, like, if you mention, like, if a character says, like, oh my gosh, and Casey does say this in the book, like, this is like Rear Window, like, savvy people will know exactly what she's talking about and what she's thinking, and it's just like a great connector between the author and the reader. And also, like, I do look at movies as kind of a distinctly, yes, there are foreign films and there are amazing foreign films, but like, it's a distinctly American art form. And I just think that, like, everyone loves movies, everyone goes to the movies, everyone watches movies, whether it's on, you know, in the theater or at home. And so it is like this shared language. And it's really fun to play around with those.
Why don't we take questions? Since everybody's read things, so
questions.
Right?
Yes.
So Survive the Night, obviously written like a screenplay. So I think a lot of us probably want to know, any of these gonna be made into movies?
I hope so. No, I mean, the thing with Hollywood is like, and all have been optioned or are in development some way, but I have nothing to do with any of it because while I love movies and TV, I don't know how any of it gets made. And part of me doesn't really want to know how the sausage gets made, so I prefer to just be ignorant to it all. So what happens is if someone says, we're interested in adapting this, I say, sure. I'm here if you have any questions. No one has ever asked me a question. No, I would love to write a screenplay, just not based on one of my books, because I wouldn't know how to. Because sometimes, like, books and movies are very different, and it requires being brutal sometimes to the source material, and I don't think I'd be able to do that to my own books, even though it might be necessary to make it into a good movie.
Yeah, screenplay at maximum is 100 pages, but generally shorter than that, and mostly dialogue, you know. So it would be hard to take a book over 300 pages and whack all, you know, the interior scenes and other stuff out of it.
Yeah, you know? I wouldn't know what to cut, and I would know that, like, things need to go, but right. I wouldn't know how to do it. And so I think, like, there are people who are very skilled at taking something that someone else wrote and then just slicing away all the fat until you get a nice, like, sleek screenplay.
Very
and that's
true.
A skill, yeah.
You know, Raymond Chandler, who, you know, is kind of an icon in mystery, if any of you read The Big Sleep or something, he did not write the screenplays for his book. So there's a wonderful story where somebody, the guy who was also a fabulous author, was writing the screenplay, and he called him, Ray. He said, you know, why does so-and-so happen in the book? And Ray said, damned if I know. I mean, he was not even a great plotter in lots of ways, but he was totally unwilling to try to take his books and turn them into movies.
Yeah, because it's some people can do it really well. Like, Gillian Flynn did an amazing job writing the screenplay for Gone Girl.
But she had a real background in screenplays before she wrote Gone Girl, so that's a different deal.
But I just wouldn't know the first like with House Across the Lake, I wouldn't know like where to even begin and like turning it into a screenplay form.
Do you guys like long form television as opposed to movies? Do you like it when there's like, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 episodes for a book as compared to a 2-hour movie? I really do. And I think, you know, the pandemic really accelerated the desire for making long form television because we're all sitting home watching television. And I think it's done books a huge service because you can explore them so much better. So, you know, you may get lucky in that one of your books will be adapted for something like 6 episodes and
some
more room for the kind of thing that you don't want to cut.
Yeah, some of them are in discussions and development for limited series like that, and some are like in development and discussion as like feature like film. And I wish I could say more, but
you can't.
Especially about this one, because there might be some exciting stuff happening about this, and I like can't say it yet, and it's been killing me.
That's why I didn't ask him. Right. So, no, this is true. We have lots of authors here who have things in the works, but they're not allowed. Some of them send me photos of being on set and all, but they're not allowed. I can't show them to anybody or, you know, talk about them, so... My phone is a treasure trove.
This phone right here?
That's the one, yeah. Well, secret password and all. I just got one the other day from somebody on set in Vancouver, and it's a wonderful photo, but, you know, then, can't tell anybody, but I wanted you to see it. I know, it's so cool. All right, another question.
Yeah.
So you write the female protagonist super exceptionally, so I would love
to know
why is it your decision to go from a female perspective, and then what's your inspiration?
Well, it started with Final Girls because I knew it had to be told by a final girl. Like, there was no way around it. And so, like, I didn't really give it that much thought because it was, okay, it has to be told by a final girl, so this is how I'm going to write it. And I really didn't, and this is, it's, whenever I talk about it, it just sounds so tricky because, like, I don't want to sound like, when I write from a female perspective, I don't think of gender first. I think of character. So I don't think, what is a woman going to do in this situation? I think, what is Quincy in Final Girls with all her backstory and all her trauma and all her anger? What is she going to do in this situation? And like same thing with Casey in The House Across the Lake and Charlie in Survive the Night, where it's very specifically character driven. And so I think like that might be the difference where like, and I like at an event last night, someone was just like, oh, thank you for thinking of women as individuals. And I'm like, yeah, you're welcome. I mean, but it just, cause we all should, but I also know that like, I'm not going to know everything. Like, and so there I have, you know, my first reader. She is one of my oldest and dearest friends. I've known her since high school. She reads everything even before I send it to my editor, and she will tell me when I mess up. And like in Survive the Night, there's a scene very early on where Charlie and Josh are just sitting out on the road trip, and Josh gets coffee and hands her a cup of coffee, and Charlie takes a sip. And my friend was like, no woman would ever do that. And so I'm like, duly noted, okay, I'm changing it, thank you. And then like, you know, my editor gets a hold of it, and my agent gets a hold of it. And so like, I do have like this wonderful resource of all women who are not afraid to be like, yeah, this is not how things work. You gotta change it. And so like, we work as a nice team. So I think hopefully it shows.
Another question?
I don't think I'd be able to do it well. It would probably be pretty awful and embarrassing, but I would love to do like a Jaws kind of thing where there is like some small town terrorized by some prehistoric creature in the water or something. Like, I just think that would be awesome because Jaws is perfect. Jaws is a perfect movie. And I think it'd be a lot of fun. for me. For the reader, not so much.
A woman chewed up on the beach. Terrific. Yeah. Great scenario. Anybody else?
Yeah. So a lot of times we read and watch movies about like how authors write, like they get in the zone or they ignore people. And I just saw a movie the other day where the person was like writing while they were on drugs and like then they finished everything. You churn out books to me personally very fast. Like, how do you do that?
Drugs. No.
Bourbon, I thought was the real answer. Come on, Riley.
I'm on cocaine right now. No, the no, I mean, it's my publisher really, really wants a book a year. And luckily, I don't have another job. So this is my only job. And so I really don't have that much of an excuse to not do a book a year. And some books are harder than others and take longer than others. And sometimes I am like literally the day before that deadline, like you know, 1 a.m. It's like, here, it's done. And then other times it's like House Across the Lake. I told my editor, you'll have it in, you know, mid-August, maybe. By like the first week of June, I was done. I'm like, here it is. And so it really depends. My daily routine is just, I do a lot of outlining because that helps me know where I need to go on every given writing day. Other than that, I have an office just dedicated to writing. I put on headphones and listen to music that doesn't contain words because words are distracting. And then I just try to keep a schedule and meet the schedule word count every day. It's very non-magical. Like it's just kind of.
Back on that, is it hard to do this, what you're doing now, the promotion part of the release and writing your next book, or do you try to separate?
I have to say, like, usually I'm finished before the publicity cycle starts. This year, not so much. So when the book tour is over, like, I have to immediately like go back into writing mode. So I gave myself June, okay, June, no writing, you're promoting. July 1st, I'm chained to my desk until that book is finished. So you do have to like schedule kind of like, okay, this is your writing time and this is your publicity time. To do it all at once, I think would drive me crazy. Like I can't imagine being on a plane and like, you know, scribbling stuff down or being on a laptop and then just like coming here and doing this. Like it would be too much for me.
But there are authors who do.
They can
there
do it so well.
There are authors who are basically living in two worlds all the time.
And, yeah.
You know, if you've watched The Lincoln Lawyer, you know, he talks about the fact that he is better researching his cases or practicing his speeches in the back of the car. And there are authors who say best writing is on airplanes. There are authors who write in the middle of Starbucks or similar, you know, who need all that energy around them. I can't imagine that. I mean, I'd be so busy gazing at everybody or, you know, listening or whatever that I wouldn't be able to write a word. But it's so interesting that every creative person seems to have his or her own way of going about it. None of them is the right way or the wrong way.
It's just what works for them. Like
that's
like
right.
Brad Parks and my friend Brad Parks writes in an Arby's.
Right.
Yeah.
And it has to be an Arby's too.
Yeah.
It can't be like McDonald's.
Like they gave him a name tag, like because he's there so much. Like and it's really cool and that works for him. I've tried like the cafe writing and I get nothing done.
Now William Kent Kruger writes in coffee houses, you know, because that's what he always did. There's some off-brand coffee house in St. Paul, Minnesota, or you know, where he's happy.
Yeah.
And then other people go to writers' retreats. There are a whole bunch of all across the country places dedicated to writers being able to like lock themselves up for a month or two and work on their manuscript. Larry Block used to be that way, as I understand it. He used to, you know, the last month because he was taking drugs and doing other stuff till he got to that point. And basically they would lock him in and just shove food under the door. And, you know, he would take 30 days and bang it out. So everybody, I've always wondered, you know, did you ever sort of wonder, how does anybody like dive off a high tower into a teacup the first time? I mean, how would you ever do it the first time? If you'd ever done it, then I could see the repeat. So I often wonder how it is that you know, the pattern is set for somebody. And I think it usually has to be some sort of circumstance.
Yeah, whatever is going on with that first book.
Writing in part is superstition. And so, you know, if it worked for you, if you didn't die in the teacup, you know, then you would do it again that way because you already knew that that worked once.
Because I used to write with a big box fan that makes like lots of noise. And that was like my white noise and it would block right. everything out. And like, I could not write without this stupid fan running. And then I don't know, I can't remember when
you
it happened.
You broke yourself.
But then all of a sudden, yeah, it's just like, oh, I don't need the fan. I can just write without it. But I do have other crutches like, you know, Spotify playlist that, you know, I like chill house music without lyrics. And so like, there are just so many of those. Like my favorite is like Beats to Think To. And it's like 9 hours long. And I do not write for 9 hours at a stretch. But just headphones, Beats to Think To, and then you get into a groove and the words just flow. Yeah.
I think Patrick has a question or two from the audience because he has emerged from our studio here.
Emerged.
Here he is.
There's some good questions coming in. Rachel would like to know, would you ever consider writing a scary book for kids?
For kids? I would like to. Before Final Girls came out, I'd written it, but I was like in the process of revising it and, you know, getting a book deal, hopefully. I needed a job. And so I got a job working in the children's section of my local library. And it was awesome. It was so much fun. I loved it so much. I'd have like little kids just run up to you and be like, do you have dinosaur books? And we're like, we do. They're right here. Here they are. And I was like, maybe I want to do this for a living. Maybe if this book thing doesn't happen, because it was like my Hail Mary. It was like, if Final Girls doesn't happen, then I'm done writing. And so I was in the process of like exploring, maybe going back to school to become a children's librarian. And so I think it would be awesome to write like a middle grade scary book. Not a YA scary book, but like, you know, middle grade and just something spooky and fun.
And then you could be R.L. Sager. You could.
Then I could, yes. I could.
Yeah. Love it.
Let's see here. I don't want to take up anybody else's questions, but Miriam would like to know, and perhaps you guys share this, what the hell is a trope? Explain.
a trope is something that's been done a lot and is generally acknowledged to be a trope, and I don't know like what the, how better
pattern.
To explain it. Yeah,
it's a pattern. You know, it's like in a
convention,
a realm,
maybe
stereotype
convention.
Maybe, but not stereotype.
No, it's
kind of applies to people.
It's like,
yeah,
it's like a locked room mystery, for example. You know, it's an impossible crime, and so you spend your time. Well, like Rear Window, looking in the window, being the voyeur, looking into somebody's
life.
That's a trope.
It's a tried and true thing that's been done several times before and, works.
Let's see here. Renee would like to know, when do you prefer writing? Are you a night creature or do you like the early mornings? Or?
I am an afternoon writer, to be honest. Which
really?
Is, yeah, it's,
that's unusual.
It's very
similar. Yeah, it is. Like I used to be a very late night writer because I used to work at a newspaper and I wouldn't get home until like 11 p.m. or midnight, and so that's when I would do my writing then. But now it's just like mornings. I like to, you know, laze around in the morning. I mean, I exercise.
Slow start, right?
Yeah, slow start. I can't like just hop out of bed and just let's write. So it usually takes me until around like lunchtime to actually like get into.
That's a very Parisian
settled.
Kind of
it really is.
Yes.
And then I write in the afternoons until dinner time.
We could give Riley a beret. He could be patient in the afternoon, put on your beret and go to work.
Anybody else have questions? Yeah.
Do you have any authors that you like or that inspire you?
We mentioned Ruth Ware. She is awesome. Jennifer Hillier, if you have not read her, she is awesome. And she has a book coming out in July that I have and I haven't been able to read it yet, and it's killing me because I've heard it's like next level good. Did you read it? Things
no,
you do
I
in the dark?
Yeah. Same problem you do. It's there sitting
and
there waiting.
Megan Miranda is also a really good one.
And Megan will be here on July 30th. I'm happy
that is
to
awesome.
Tell you for, and it will be, I'm not sure if it's her first time, but she has not been here for a really long time.
And then he's going to be like probably like, he's going to be thrilled and probably embarrassed because he thinks I might be stalking him. There is a guy named Clay McLeod Chapman. He is so good, and he writes more horror stuff. He has a book called Whisper Down the Lane, which is like satanic panic kind of stuff. It rocks. It is so good. And like every time like I tweet about it or like say something on Instagram, he's like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'm like, you're probably thinking I'm like stalking you and obsessed with you, but really I just think the book is that good. So that's a really good one that I recommend to everyone. You first, because you have, yeah, and then you.
What made you pick this genre?
Because I like it. Like, it's what I...
What made you fall in love with it? Like, is there a certain movie or book where you just, like, this is it?
Well, And Then There Were None was very influential to me. I read that, I think, in sixth grade because my sister was reading it for school, which is awesome that you get to read that for school. And she told me the plot of it, and I was like, really? Books like this exist? And then I read it, and like, oh my God, this is so good. This is so, so good. So that was one. And then just Hitchcock. Like, I fell in love with Alfred Hitchcock movies probably at like age 12 or 13. And like, once you see like Rear Window or Vertigo at that young of age, it just, it expands your whole mind. Because again, it's like movies can be like this. And so, yeah, Hitchcock and Then There Were None.
Witness for the Prosecution combines Agatha Christie and Hitchcock, you know, and it's absolutely wonderful.
With a shocker of an ending.
So, And Then There Were None, there's a British writer called Alice Feeney. Some of you may have read it. So she'll be here on August 30th. That's symmetrical. Megan on July 30th and Alice on August 30th. But anyway, she has written a new version of And Then There Were None, which is about, it's called the Darker.
Daisy Darker,
yeah. But it's supposed to be absolutely fabulous. So I have to pace myself. I have to read all the books for June, and now I'm just starting into all the books for July. So I can't, you know, leap ahead and read Daisy Darker, because then I might not have read The House Across the Lake, and we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, and it feels like, because you probably like had the same problem, where like a huge perk of my job is like getting books early, like books that I really want to read early. And then it becomes a problem when like I'm writing or busy promoting, and so I have all these books that I really want to read, and I can't read them yet. So like, you all will probably be reading like the Jennifer Hillier book and Daisy Darker before I'm able to get to them. And so
it's true.
That's
it's
awesome.
Like, it's
yeah.
a torture. I have to pace myself. There are, I counted for July, I have 147 advanced reading copies of books that I need to look at. I don't get to read all of them, but I wind up reading most of them. But the problem is I have to finish June, which I'm just now doing, in order to have this conversation and other stuff before I get to July. So Patrick will tell you, he's watched me do this for years. I am an unlucky speed reader in the sense it only takes me about an hour and a half to read a book. That sounds amazing, but it's terrible. Because you know, if I didn't
some of us would beg to differ.
Yeah. No, it really, I mean, because there are only so many good books, and you know, if you and having read them too fast, then I have too much time to read books I don't want to read. But that's another question. And we all define good books differently,
that's
right?
True.
A good book for me is not necessarily a good book for you. You know, the author's voice. I don't know what you all read for, but I read for voice. I read for the personality that the author is conveying. I don't really care that much about the plot because I've read practically every plot there is. You know, so what I want the author to engage me. I want to read the voice.
Yeah, I like a combo. I like a really good voice.
Well, then a plot's a great bonus.
And then
it's a bonus, but it isn't. Patrick, you're a wonderful reader. Patrick is actually our very best bookseller. What do you read for?
They don't care what I read. They want to know what you read for. Kind of the same, you know, I mean, a good voice, something new and unusual, just good writing too. I don't know about you. I'd like a good sentence.
Well, that's part of voice though, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I mean.
Yeah. One with a great voice, I think you'll agree, was Hidden Pictures by Jason Rechulak. It's really good. And the narrator is it's a very interesting voice and a very fun book.
And one of the things that's best about Hidden Pictures, since you brought it up, is that part of the voice is the pictures that
the little girl is
drawing in the book. And her voice, to a great degree, are the pictures. And as the pictures go throughout the book, it's telling her story. And the last picture reveals. I mean, it's an incredibly
good
book.
It's very good.
I did a wonderful talk with him and Grady Hendrix. It was one of the highlights of my month.
That's right. Was that virtual or were they here?
It was virtual, sadly. But, you know, nonetheless, it's just an amazing book. We maybe have 3 or 4 copies left, but, you know, that Jason has autographed it with his little stamps. But I thought that was a whole new brave way to tell a story, is to have, you know, basically a voiceless child who tells her story through drawings. And they're the kind of drawings that a little kid would do. They're not sophisticated, you know, I'm the artist at the publisher kind of a thing. They're like, you know, crayon
stick
and stick
drawings.
Thing.
And yeah, some of them are so creepy.
And the last drawing is so amazing.
But you had another question.
Oh,
yes.
I did. So another trope could be women's names, since you write from a woman's point of view. Do you ever lean into, like, when you pick your character names, some of those tropes, or are they inspired by your friends, or how do you pick the names for your characters?
Quincy in Final Girls was, because the Final Girls trope is, you know, like, gender-neutral names, and so I knew that she had to have one, because I just liked that. The others, not so much. I mean, Charlie in Survive the Night has a, you know, another gender-neutral name, but that one I liked because she's named after a Hitchcock heroine from a really good movie. Who here has seen Shadow of a Doubt? It's really good, super good, and not like he's known for so many other things, but Shadow of a Doubt is very, very good. But a lot of times, I really, because I was asked this last night about, like, where'd you get the name Casey, and I don't know. Like, I don't remember. It just, like, popped into my head for some reason, and I don't know why. Oh, and I forgot to mention, and I don't know why I keep forgetting to mention this. So the lake house that I rented, this is the fun side note on this house, which is, like, it is like the house in the book. So we were there. The Wi-Fi was down the very first day, so someone had to come and fix the Wi-Fi. And he fixed the Wi-Fi and said, okay, we'll fix the Wi-Fi. And so we're sitting there on the porch in a rocking chair, and he's like, you know who else liked to sit there when she stayed here? And we're like, who? He's like, Dolly Parton. She was at this lake house.
In your chair.
In that chair, yes. We did a game, like, the whole week. Like, did she use the spoon? Did she sit in this chair? Like, it just, and it has nothing to do with the book at all. I just think it's fun to mention. But yes, a question in the back.
Okay, so when it comes to the thriller genre, are there any dark things that you're like, I would never touch that, it's too disturbing for me, or are you really open to anything that you feel inspired by from the book?
I would never hurt an animal. And child abuse, no. And sexual assault, no. So there's a lot of lines. Like, my books can be dark, but I also want them to still be fun in a twisted way. And I don't want to get to, like, the point where, like, things get so dark that it's not enjoyable.
I get the animal thing, but don't some kids just need killing?
Well, yes, yeah.
So we've talked about tropes, and an absolute trope in crime fiction is that no dog dies. That is the trope. Cats have a risky life, but no dog dies.
Because, well, I'm an animal lover, and so, like, I wouldn't be able to write about, like, a death of a dog. Like, I wouldn't be able to do it. And so, like, that's why there are no animals in my books, really.
Very wise. Yeah. Patrick, did you have another question?
Yeah, there's a question about, oh gosh, I forgot her name. Forgive me. Fiona. She would like to know a few things. Do you have any interesting rituals when you finish a book? Do you allow yourself a cigarette, like in that movie? I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, Misery.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly.
Not really, no. I mean, sometimes, and again, this has been difficult because of the pandemic, but sometimes I time it so we're like, okay, I'm finishing the book right before vacation, and it's like, okay, book is done, I'm going to Disney World. But, like, not nothing.
How much
really
time off do you allow yourself?
It really depends on when I finish it. Because I finished this one so early, I had months all to myself when I really honestly should have been working on my next book. I had a lovely relaxing fall, everyone.
Fiona also has a question about writer's block. Do you ever suffer from it, or is it?
I do. I mean, sometimes, like, I've heard, you know, some authors, like, writer's block doesn't exist. That's probably true. There is writer's suckiness, where it's not really block. It's just like, wow, this is crap today. What
writer's
I'm doing.
Blah.
Yeah, writer's blah is a really good way to describe it. Yeah, and to snap myself out of it, I usually just read. I find a book that I know is going to be really good, and then just even just like a chapter or two would be like, gets the juices flowing.
Get your groove back.
Yeah.
Right.
I saw. Yeah.
Do you always go in knowing the ending of your book, and if so, have you ever veered away from it after starting to write it?
Pretty much. Like I always start with like the elevator pitch, which is like the two sentences you would say to a Hollywood executive if you were stuck in the elevator. And so like for House Across the Lake, it was Rear Window on a Lake. And then immediately it's, okay, who populates this? Who is going to be the main character? What's her deal? How is she messed up? Because they're all messed up. And, you know, how awful are her parents? Because all my parents are awful. Not in real life. My real life parents are wonderful. But in my books, the parents are, yeah. And so then it becomes, what can I do that's new and exciting and different? And that's when I think about, what's the twist here? What's the end game? Where is this all going to pan out? And yeah, it does change halfway through sometimes where I'll just, something else will pop into my head. Like the only time I started a book without knowing where it was going to end was Last Time I Lied. And it has a really good ending. And it was literally halfway point where like I was getting to where I'm like, I need to figure out what's happening. And it just popped in my head like, oh, it's this. But never again will I start a book in earnest without knowing where it's going to lead. Because it really sucked, like being halfway done with the book and still having no clue where I was going with it.
Yeah, that's like driving off without a map. It was, not knowing where you're going and no Google on your phone.
I was pretty frantic for a while. Yeah, it
not
was
bad.
My poor editor. Yep, you in the back. I get to choose who to ask. The blurb thing I think I speak for every author when I say, blurbs should not exist. Like, have you ever bought a book based on the blurb? Can we all call my publisher right now and you can tell them this? No, because it's such a thing where it's such a big ask to go, like, usually it's a friend, but sometimes it's a stranger. And like, you know, Ruth Ware was wonderful and blurb locked every door for me. I had no communication with her at the time. Like, it was like literally out of the blue. I DM'd her on Twitter and be like, hi, do you want to read my book? And she was like, I'm really busy, but yeah, sure. And she did, and she provided this wonderful blurb. And so like, it's really generosity among authors where we try our best to, when we're asked, it's an honor, but also there's a lot of times when we're like, I do not have the bandwidth right now to read this and blurb it. And then there's sometimes, you know, there's some favors being exchanged, and sometimes but it's always very awkward and very fraught. And I think all of us wish that we didn't have to go through the process. But I can pick like who, I can suggest, like my editor would be like, who would you love to blurb this book? And like in this case, like, it was great, where I was like, Alex Michael Eadie's, Laura Dave, and someone St. James. She's like, I'll ask. And they all said yes, and they all provided such wonderful, wonderful quotes. And so I'm very, very fortunate and very grateful to them.
So, Terry, is Jacob there? No. Could you run in the back room, and there's a tub where there is a bunch of books that says ARCs I'm giving away at events, because once again, I forgot, we give out a free book Yeah, but I have to have the book, right? Just one. Yeah, one will be good. Ooh. So you should have, if you bought the book here, I hope that you have a number in your book. Am I right? On your ticket? Which is the number that you will line up with, but it's also the number for the Against the Law lottery that we are about. My husband says I'm going to be done by the IRS one of these days for doing this, but since the advanced reading copies that I get are free, and we're just giving it away, I think I'm safe. So I sent Terry to get one. And you're going to get to, she's bringing the whole damn tub. Come on, Terry. You don't want to be responsible, do you? Okay. Let's make Jay. I'm going to make you, Riley, pick a book out of there that you would like to give away tonight. And then you're going to also have to pick the number.
Let's see. What looks good?
It's a totally eclectic collection.
Okay. I've actually. Oh, this one sounds good, too. I will do, because I mentioned him earlier.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you. This is Ghost Eaters by Clay McLeod Chapman.
Ah, how wonderful that we had it.
I blurbed this. and it's to whoever gets it, I'm just warning you, like, it is scary as you know what. Like, it's intense. Like, so
40. Okay. So I need you to pick a number between 1 and 40.
1 and 40.
And that's the person, if you're here, who will get the book.
Let's do 27.
Oh, we have a winner. Wonderful. This is how we lure you to come to more events, right? You get all this fun and a free book.
Enjoy.
I hope you enjoy it. You should make him sign the blurb at the back when it's your turn to
lie. It doesn't have my blurb on the back.
Oh,
it's,
no. Yeah. Well, bad news. Well, I want to thank all of you very much for coming tonight. And I want to say that you guys have asked some of the best questions that I have heard at our events. So you do indeed have a upscale group of fans here.
They're some smart readers. Yeah,
no
I gotta
kidding.
Say, I'm lucky.
Yes,
thank
you
guys
are.
For coming today.
Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.